Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Eleni Bettinelli.
So this week has been interesting.
It's been busy.
We've entered into a new kind of thing for our family.
Right.
A new phase. So just to start, the three oldest kids are away at summer camp, Scout summer camp, for a whole week.
We've never done this before.
We have never done this before.
we've never had any of the kids really spend the night with like
away from us,
with neither one of us with them.
Right.
Like, all the camping trips they've gone on so far, one or the other of us has been there.
Although no, there was the one that was at Camp Sayre, where Bella stayed over and Sophie didn't.
Right, but only Bella. Okay, so Bella has done it.
And it was like the next town over. It wasn't that far away. Yeah, but this is a big deal. It's a whole week away for all three of them. And apparently, from all reports from the leaders, they're having a good time.
They've been very kindly sending us photographs and updates so that we can kind of have an idea of what's going on.
Yeah, the camp is on Cape Cod, and it's being run by the neighboring scout troop. I think we mentioned before. So we drove them down on Saturday morning and dropped them off, set up their tents, sat around for a long time.
There was a lot of sitting down before the campsites were assigned, so we were waiting for the assignment.
And waiting. Yes, but then we finally got this set up, and there was some separation anxiety, some tears. The kids were fine. It was me and Melanie that we were crying. Go away! No, but don't you want us to hug you for a little longer? Go away! No, there was a little bit, I think, of on their part.
Yeah.
But it was fine. They're doing great. They're earning their merit badges and doing all the bird watching and other stuff. I'm not even sure all they're doing.
Canoeing and swimming.
Yeah. So, those three of them are there. Two of them are with us. Anthony and Lucy have stayed behind. Next year, it'll be four of them. This is very strange to be you and me and two kids.
It
is a very odd experience. So, yeah. And today we spent with my mom. I picked her up this morning at my brother's house, and we brought her over, and she went to Mass with us, and she hung out with us all day. And that was nice.
It was very nice to have her.
But it was quiet, because without the older kids here to talk to Grandma, the younger ones are kind of quiet with her.
Yeah, they're still not, like, super chatty with Grandma yet.
Yeah, so it was me and Grandma just sitting around being quiet a lot, dozing off in the, we have a new screened-in canopy in the backyard, and so we sat out there in the shade and dozed this afternoon.
Lucy and I made chocolate muffins, because she's been wanting muffins for a while, and so I told her I'd make them with her this afternoon.
And I went to Whole Foods with Anthony and picked up some steaks for dinner and just do something nice for my mom. So that was nice. It was a beautiful day. Like we had yesterday. So when we dropped them off, it was the fourth day of a heat wave. It was in the 90s, humidity.
It was a hot day for setting up tents.
We were just all
dripping in sweat,
dripping and miserable. It was yuck. But today was beautiful, dry, clear, not too hot. It was a really nice day. So they'll be there till next Saturday, so this is going to be a big week. So the big thing is I want to figure out ways to make it like sort of a special week for Anthony and Lucy.
Meanwhile, I want to do some house cleaning and organization and all the school planning. So
I'm going to take the two of them and do something for at least a couple of days. We might go camping. I'm still going to figure out the logistics of that, but we're going to do stuff away with just the three of us to leave Melanie at home to do the things that she wants to do. And that, I think that'll work out.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yeah. The other thing that happened this week, it was our anniversary.
That was 16 years.
And we didn't do anything special for it because we were packing three kids for camp.
Yeah, it was like...
So, because our anniversary was Friday, the day before.
Right, the day before they left. So we did get takeout. We got Jamaican takeout.
No, we got Vietnamese takeout.
We got Vietnamese takeout.
Jamaican was your birthday.
My birthday was Jamaican takeout. Yeah,
it was wrong. Jamaican me crazy.
Right. So we got Vietnamese takeout. It was nice.
It was really good. And here's the thing. Last time you got Vietnamese takeout from the same place, it was really expensive. This time, I didn't.
Well, last time we didn't get takeout, we got delivery.
Right. We did delivery through DoorDash. This time we said, let's go to their website, order directly from them, and go pick it up because it's not that far away. And it was like 60. And we also got I think one or two fewer dishes because we realized we overpurchased last time.
We didn't.
But it was still like half the cost.
Yeah.
It was crazy how much less expensive it was to not use DoorDash. So, pro tip, if you're ordering food and if you get away with it, don't do DoorDash. Go pick it up yourself. That's just
And it was really like it was a pleasant drive with a couple of the kids.
Yeah.
They had the food ready as soon as I walked in the door, so it was no trouble.
Right. And good place, good food, get some pho and some spring rolls, and you got a vermicelli bowl, and so did Sophie. I think she got a vermicelli, yep. Two different ones. So they have just love Vietnamese food. And we're so lucky to live one town over from a town with a very large Vietnamese community, which means there's a lot of really good Vietnamese food.
Mm-hmm.
So we're very blessed. So that was a bit about it for our anniversary. Cause like I said,
I bought some cheesecake when we were out.
Oh yes. We did celebrate with a dessert. It was one of those multi-flavored cheesecakes.
Cheesecake sampler plate.
Yes.
Yeah, we had to do last minute like runs to Target for more clothes because none of our kids actually have
a whole week's worth of clothes. A whole
7 days worth of like shorts and socks and underwear and stuff.
Well, between the two girls, they kind of have one set of clothing, like one big wardrobe of clothes that they share.
Yeah. So I realized that if they were like, and normally I do laundry a few times a week, so it's not really a big deal. But if they're away, there's no laundry at camp.
Yeah.
So they needed a week's worth of clothes.
So a few more of this or that. Locks for the foot lockers that I never end up using. New foot lockers. That was a whole other thing. Yeah. But done. One thing I wanted to mention was after I dropped my mom off back at my brother's house, I was talking to him. He and his wife and their girls had been away. Their oldest is also going to camp, different camp. And
their youngest.
Their youngest. Sorry. I don't know why I said oldest. Their youngest. And she's at a different camp. But the two sisters, their youngest and then the next youngest, are the two girls. The next youngest. So Teresa's the youngest. Catherine is the next youngest. I'm going to call them Teresa and Catherine. Teresa's at camp. Catherine leaves this week for college for the first time. She's a freshman in college going to Melanie's alma mater.
University of Dallas.
University of Dallas. And so this was their goodbye. So that was a big deal for them. So say a prayer for them. And then we found out that one of my other nephews, John Paul, who I've mentioned before is a second lieutenant in the Army and is trained to become a helicopter pilot. He's found out where he's going on his assignment. He's going to be a Black Hawk pilot at Fort Bragg with the 82nd Airborne, which is hoorah.
Oh, did he officially get the,
yes,
the assignment?
That is official. The other option was the Fort Campbell in Kentucky, where we drove. I was telling John, like, hey, we just drove past that. It's like, yeah, it's just an hour from Nashville. When we went to Kentucky that time.
Right.
So that was really cool. And yeah, I mean, so they're doing awesome. Their other boys are great. I mean, it's just really great to see how well my nieces and nephews are doing.
They were also very little when we first met.
Yes. I was recently looking at our anniversary, looking at the pictures of our wedding and seeing how small they were there.
Now they're grown up
and getting ready to get married and go off to be in the military and all the stuff like this, go to college. It is wild. Anyway. So that's what we've been doing. It's a lot. It doesn't, but it's only like a couple things, but it was a lot like of preparation with the summer camp. That was a big deal.
Yeah. We've never done this before. I'm already making a list of like what we should have done different. But
yeah, there was the opportunity where I could have stayed overnight the first night. That might have helped.
That might have eased some of the separation anxiety.
Yeah, I think they're okay now, though. Yeah. But yeah, so they're doing well. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was in the food section of our podcast, I wanted to talk about artichokes. Artichokes have a long history in my family. When my mom, who's not Italian at all, she's French and Russian. When she was first dating my dad, or when they were engaged or first married or whatever, they would go to my grandma's house on Sunday, because this is what everyone did. And you go to mom's house on Sunday for Sunday dinner. And one of the foods they would eat would be artichokes. And the way you eat an artichoke is you peel off, you know, they're cooked, you peel off one of the leaves, and then you kind of use your teeth to pull off the tender meat, you might say, of the leaf at the bottom of each leaf. That's got a lot of flavor to it. You pull off with your teeth. But my mom didn't know what they were doing. And she leans over to my dad and says, "Dom, why are they kissing the leaves?" It's like, they're not kissing the leaves. She thought it was like some strange Italian ritual where you kiss where you kiss the leaves as you peel them off until you get to the heart of the artichoke, which is what you really want to eat. No, they're not kissing it. Now, artichokes, when I was a kid, the only way we ever had them was stuffed artichokes. Breadcrumbs, cheese, like Parmesan, some herbs, maybe parsley or something, and then you kind of stuff all that in among the leaves, and then it was put in a pressure cooker and pressure cooked.
That was not at all how I ate artichokes. We just had steamed, and then you just dipped them in lemon and butter.
Right. And the thing is I really like the stuffed artichokes. I mean, all that bread and cheese and yum, but it's a lot of work, which is why I never make them. But now I started making them the steamed way.
Yes. Much easier.
Much easier. Just, it's like you put it in a steamer with some water. You cut off the top quarter of the artichoke. And you want artichokes that are pretty tightly closed and firm. And you cut off the top quarter. You trim the stem. And in fact, what I like to do is I like to use a paring knife or a peeler and peel the outer layer off the stem, because if you do that, once it's cooked, you can eat all the stem is the same as the heart. It's all edible, all yummy. So don't throw it away, no matter what the recipe tells you. Anyway, you trim it, you put it in the steamer, you boil the water inside, you put it in the steamer, stem side up, and then you put a tight cover lid on it, and you steam it for 40 minutes for the large ones. If they're large artichokes, if they're small artichokes, you should do like 25 minutes, but 40 minutes, and they're done. And then you take them out, and you mentioned the lemon butter. That's a good thing. But we had some leftover hollandaise sauce the other day. They were like, "Hey, let's try the hollandaise sauce." Oh my gosh, it's so awesome! I was taking, like, once I got to the heart and peeled off all the choke, I get the stem in my hand. It's like a cone, and I'm like spooning the hollandaise onto it. Oh my gosh, so awesome, so decadent. It was. This is the only way I want to eat artichokes from now on.
Hollandaise sauce is the best.
Hollandaise. And this is the, like we mentioned before, easy hollandaise. We talked about in episode 82, this blender hollandaise sauce, where it's, you know, butter, melted butter, egg yolks, and lemon juice in a blender. And basically, boom. I mean, there's a couple steps in there.
We'll, still need to figure out what to do with the egg whites.
Yeah. Well, what is a good way to use up old egg whites that is not making an egg white omelet, because those are gross?
Yeah. And not angel food cake, because really, we don't need more cake.
No. So one of the things that uses egg whites a lot is in a lot of Chinese cooking, you put like the chicken and the other stuff, like you coat it in egg white and an egg white cornstarch slurry, and it gives it a nice coating. That's the only thing I can think of for using egg whites.
Yeah, all I can think of is like meringue and macaroons and things. And
sweet, sugary
treats that I don't need.
We need savory uses for egg whites.
I do not need to make meringues. I don't even really like meringues that much.
Someone invented meringues as a way to use up egg whites.
Yes.
So if you got any ideas, we'd love to hear them. But we got to figure out what to do with all these egg whites that were in.
Unfortunately, a lot of them have ended up getting thrown away, because I've like saved them and then never use them.
Right. And so you got to toss them.
Yeah.
So artichokes. This is artichoke season. Get them. The other, you know what else season it is? It's peach season.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Oh, so ripe peaches. I'm waxing rhapsodic again because every year when peaches are in season and they're ripe and they're juicy and they're unlike peaches at any other time of the year, peaches the rest of the year are inedible compared to these. It's so awesome. So that's food. Any other foods we need? We have been, again, refer to packing for summer camp. We've been having pretty basic dinners.
We have not been
cooking. We've had chicken curry. We've had, you know, pork chops. You know, nothing interesting or exciting that we haven't already talked about many times. On the way home from dropping off grandma, by the way, we stopped at Crescent Ridge again. Remember, we talked about Crescent Ridge ice cream last time, and I was with the Anthony and Lucy, and so we stopped for an ice cream. And I told Lucy, we should get a cup in a cone. So you put the, she's like, what is that? It's like, so the ice cream goes in the cup, and then you put a cone on top so you can have the experience of both. Oh no, I want a cone. I'm like, how fast are you going to be able to eat that? I don't want a cup. Okay. So we get the cone, we walk across the parking lot, and the ice cream falls off the cone onto the parking lot.
And that's where you get the cup.
Yes. Now, there was a gigantic line. There was no way I was getting back in the line. I pick up the ice cream, I plop it back on the cone, I wipe off as much of the dirt as I can, and then she complains, there's still sand in it! So I'm like, I did what dads must do. I licked all the sand off.
You are a hero.
I'm a hero.
I would not have done that.
Yeah. I'm like, the grit. I mean, the ice cream is awesome, but the grit in my teeth. Oh, it was, yeah. So, and then in the car, you know, she said, you know, when daddy says something, you listen. Do what daddy says. He's smarter than I am. That's right, girl. You listen to me. You keep saying that. So, yeah, that was a
hard one lesson.
That was a hard lesson to learn, but she's learned it. I mean, it's not like the ice cream went to waste. I was not going to throw it away.
Well, we'll see if she remembers next time.
Yeah. Oh, well, a reminder. Remember? Oh, yeah. Anyway, let's talk about what we've been reading and watching. We watched the new Marvel series, What If? Now, this is an animated series based on the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where each episode imagines a variation or a variant on what we know of as the Marvel Universe. For example, what if instead of Steve Rogers becoming a super soldier, it was Captain Carter, Agent Carter, Peggy Carter. I'm trying to remember what her name was. And she got super soldiered. What would have happened after that? And then it imagines it. And Steve ends up becoming, you know, he's still skinny, gawky guy. So Tony Stark's dad, Mr. Stark, builds him an Iron Man suit, basically a World War II version of the Iron Man suit that's powered by the Tesseract, which they got away from Hydra when Captain America couldn't, et cetera, et cetera.
So in other words, Agent Carter is better than Captain America because she got the Tesseract back.
There was a little of that going on. There was a little bit of hear me, you know, I am woman, hear me roar.
I thought it was a fun episode.
But it was, yes. Overall, it was a fun, good episode. I liked it. It wasn't super heavy-handed on that. There was a little bit of the misogynistic general thing, which, I don't know, maybe it was a lot like the Agent Carter series, which kind of bugged me. They really played that hand a lot. And I'm like, can we just, like, stipulate and move on and have some other, talk about some other things? Besides how misogynistic the other agents are toward her, it had a lot of promise. I really liked the character. I just felt like the writers leaned on that theme more than they needed to. But in this, it wasn't too bad. I thought the animation was really good. What did you think of it?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it was good.
I mean, I didn't particularly note the animation, but it was good.
I don't know. I guess I've been paying attention a lot more animation with Bad Batch and some other stuff like that. That I don't watch a lot of cartoons, animated stuff, so I don't know. But I've been watching more of it lately, so it's I noticed how good the animation was in this.
Yeah, I, I didn't like dislike it. I didn't particularly remark on it.
Okay. So, future ones will be like, have what if, I can never remember the name of the character from Black Panther. I was going to say Chakotay, but that's Star Trek. Chaka Khan.
No.
yeah.
Now you've got me forgetting because I knew it before you.
Before I did my Chaka Khan thing. Yeah. Anyway, there's one where he actually becomes Doctor Strange, where he gets the cape and all that. So it's going to be interesting to see how they do it. And there's a zombie one. Wakanda Forever. What is it?
Wakanda Forever?
No. What's the character's name? Black Panther's character. Like, everybody's yelling it at their phone right now because... Okay.
I'm looking it up. I'm just not seeing. No.
Black Panther was played Chadwick Boseman.
Yeah, I can think Chadwick Boseman. I'm the name is on and the tip of my
IMDb
tongue.
Is loading slowly because that's what they do. He played
T'Challa.
T'Challa, that's right. T'Challa Khan?
No, T'Challa. Stop. See, this is why it gets messed up in your head and in mine, because you say the wrong thing right after we say the right thing. You
know, it's actually a mnemonic. It helps me remember.
No, it does not help you remember.
It does not help you remember. Okay. I wonder who's playing. They're getting to replace him. If they're going to have like another actor play the character, or they're going to kill off the character and have another Black Panther. I'm kind of curious.
Another king.
Hail to the king, baby.
I don't know. I'm just sad that Chadwick Boseman.
Yes, he was kind of awesome. The actor.
He was, as a person. Yeah.
Yeah. A friend of yours knew him. I think we talked about that.
Yeah, I think we did.
Yeah. All right. So we watched What If, and then I finished reading a book called another one in the Star Wars, the High Republic series called The Rising Storm. This was one of the best of this new series. And I'll tell you why. Because it really gives you a sense of what the Jedi were like at the height of their, not powers, but of, well, I guess of their powers, the height of the order at its best. Like, how would the Force work with Jedi as they were supposed to be? Not decadent and corrupt and kind of losing it in the prequels, but when they were at their best. And it was fascinating because it's like things like, the Jedi, like, they got their power in the Force from other people around them who thought good of them, who loved them. Like, they gained power from love and courage and encouragement and stuff like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was really kind of wild. And, and a Jedi who is tempted to the dark side and kind of gives in, and the other Jedi, he's not cast out, but he's helped back on the path and given a means by which to recover himself.
So this is basically when we're told that Luke needs to restore balance to the Force. We don't really know what balance looks like.
Yes.
Even in the prequels, that the Force is already not unbalanced.
Right. When we
so the High Republic is what the Force looks like when it's balanced.
Yes. When the Jedi were the way, like what exactly the Jedi were supposed to be. The Jedi when they were the best at what they did.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's no Sith. It's like it's not like it's a the Dark Lord is out there manipulating things. There's no Sith in it so far as far as I could tell.
But
there is an enemy called the Nihil. They're a kind of chaotic group of pirates, basically. Chaos pirates. And yeah, it's really good. I mean, there's the Republic itself is at its height, and this challenge they're facing is really challenging the Republic and really putting it on its heels. And this may actually be the beginning of the fall of the Republic. You know, it takes place hundreds of years, several hundred years before the prequels, but this Yoda is still one of the most powerful Jedi, but he's conveniently off somewhere. He's not in the story, which is kind of interesting. I think they decided Yoda would be too easy. Like, he'd be the recognizable character that we all know, and therefore, boom, here he is. But it's like, it's interesting to see things like, oh, the Togruta, you know, Ahsoka's race are not yet part of the Republic, you know, and they're an independent group. And, you know, like, so things that we know of in the current movies and stuff that has not taken place yet, you know.
Right.
It's fascinating. It's good. Some of the books, it's been uneven. Some of the books have been better than others. This was one of the better ones, I have to say.
And what was the title of this one?
The Rising Storm.
The Rising Storm.
Yes. So I'll be curious to see. And they have, there's a couple things. They keep introducing alternative lifestyle stuff in them. Was not a big fan of that. Like, it just kind of gratuitous. Like, you know, but it's what we do now. This is the society we live in. We have to put all the representation. We have to put all this stuff in there. There was also a reference to a Jedi falling from his promises of celibacy, and in that, nothing graphic, but still, you know, it's what they're doing. So I'm not necessarily comfortable with giving this one to the kids.
Right.
But they do have some YA novels, including one that kind of takes place within the events that are in this novel, which is interesting, that I'm going to check out and maybe recommend that. Well,
sometimes YA is...
Yes. There's, well, younger than middle grade.
Middle grade.
8 to 12, I think it was.
Said. Okay, that's not YA.
I can never remember what these categories are, but 8 to 12. Was this like junior grade or middle grade? So that's what I've been doing. But you've finished a couple books.
Yeah. Okay. So I first read one that was suggested in one of my homeschooling book groups. It was called The Forbidden Temptation of Baseball, which it's a great intriguing title.
Yeah. I don't look at you reading a baseball book.
It was not really a baseball book, despite the title. So what it is a historical novel. Like we said, a middle grade novel. And so basically, in the 1870s, the Emperor of China was convinced to send 120 boys and young men to the United States to study English and to hopefully learn enough English to be accepted to universities and to study science and engineering so that they could bring back Western knowledge and technology to China. And so this is the story told from the point of view of one of those boys. He's one of the youngest of the boys who sent to the United States. And he comes with his older brother. And as the story starts, they're on a train from the West Coast to Connecticut, which is where the program is located. And they get held up by train robbers, which actually historically happened. Like, one of the groups of Chinese scholars was held up by Jesse James.
Huh.
So cool. Like, his older brother ends up saving their gold, which they've kept they've brought with them to pay the people who are hosting them. So they stay with families. And although the main character is fictitious, most of the setup and stuff is real. So they stay with the host families, and they've been told, like, they're supposed to learn English and learn American, like, science and technology, but they don't want them to lose their Chinese culture and heritage. So they are under strict orders not to cut off their queue. The long braid that they wear, which signifies allegiance and loyalty to the emperor. So if they cut it off, they're sent home. Like, it's automatic. You go home. They're not supposed to date American girls, and they're not supposed to play baseball.
Okay.
So that's where the title comes from, The Forbidden Temptation of Baseball. Well, it turns out that our protagonist, the family he's staying with, had actually lost their only son. And so it creates this really interesting dynamic where there's some sort of resentment, but there's also sort of a sense that these two Chinese boys are kind of supposed to take the place of the lost son. The father of the family is a Protestant minister. And so they're also supposed to not join any American, like, Christian churches. They can go to church because that's kind of expected culturally, that they'll go to church with their host families, but they can't convert. So all of these tensions play out really interestingly. The protagonist, his name is Leong, but they call him Leon.
Right.
It is Americanized, his name. And so he goes by Leon through most of the book. He is very excited about science and engineering. He loves the railroad, the train. Like, he keeps sneaking off to look at the engine and get closer looks at how the train works. Kind of reminds me of Anthony in that way. Like, I could see Anthony, like, running off and, like, trying to figure out how everything right. works in the engine.
Yes.
But his older brother is resentful and does not want to be in America. He had had hopes of studying for the Chinese civil service exam, and he's very mad that he's been taken away from that and sent to America instead. And he has no interest in learning English, and he's not very good at English, whereas he was very good at memorization of Chinese poetry and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So there's this interesting interpersonal conflicts, and it was a really great look at a bit of history that I knew nothing about. I really thoroughly enjoyed it, and hoping some of the kids will pick it up and read it.
Cool.
And then the other novel I read was one I picked up from the library. Several of my friends have recommended Barbara Pym to me, and I have never read anything by her. So I picked up the only Barbara Pym novel that was on the shelf in the library, and I have no idea if it's one of her better books. I kind of get a feeling it might not be, but it was called Quartet in Autumn. And it was a very odd novel. It was about four elderly people who are working together in an office in London, and they aren't friends really, except they're just coworkers.
Right.
But they're all lonely. One of the men, it's two men and two women. One of the men is a widower, and then the other three have never been married. And they're just very kind of sad, lonely people.
And nothing really happens in this novel?
Okay, well, I wouldn't say that. It's not, it's definitely not a dramatic novel. So the two women retire and then are kind of don't know what to do with themselves because they really don't have friends or family or a life outside of the office. Like, they all kind of, I would say, lead lives of kind of sad desperation. The least desperate is the widower, who's sort of a church junkie. Like, he's all about all the church stuff all the time. Like, every day he goes to a different church and all the celebrations and feast days.
Anyone who's ever worked for the church knows someone like that.
Right. Like, he's always like, who's having a festival today? Where can I go to a special, like, Saints Day service or whatever? And he's like, makes the rounds.
Is
of
it
all
Catholic
the
or just high Anglican?
They're high Anglican, Anglo-Catholic.
Okay.
So they're in communion with the Church of England, but they celebrate all the Saints Days and the Stations of the Cross and all of the smells and bells. And you wouldn't be able to tell the difference really from being Catholic, except
they don't follow the Pope.
They don't follow the Pope. But one of the two women dies of breast cancer and surprisingly leaves her house to the single bachelor guy, who you kind of get the feeling that they both had some sort of interest in, but they never acted on it.
Huh.
Like, he was kind of interested in her and she was kind of interested in him, but they never said anything or did anything about it. And so she ends up leaving her house to him. And ironically, after her death, the three survivors keep having to, like circumstances throw them together. They plan her funeral. They go to her funeral. The churchy guy was Edwin was the one who found her in her kitchen. She was kind of struck, and then he calls an ambulance and takes her to the hospital, and she dies in the hospital.
Like, had a stroke.
Wasn't really clear. It wasn't really clear what exactly she died of. She'd kind of stopped eating, and it sounds like maybe she'd had a reoccurrence of the cancer, but it never really specified.
Okay. This sounds like a Merchant Ivory movie, which, like, it's just like 2 hours where nothing much actually happens.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of felt like a lot of it was very sad. Like, there's sort of the social worker who keeps checking up on this woman who's got the cancer survivor, but it kind of ends with the three of them almost being reinvigorated. Like, now they've got sort of her death is almost like the push they need to kind of do something else with their lives to kind of get out of the rut.
Okay.
So there was a little bit of a hopeful turn at the end, but
it just sounds like kind of an exploration of there are probably lots of people out there who are like this, where they get up, they go to work. They don't really have a life apart from the job that they have.
I mean, it reminds me a lot in a way of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Like, we all need to have meaning in our lives. And if we don't have meaning
or purpose. Right.
Right. Like, and he talked about like the difference in the concentration camp, which is what sort of fueled the book, the difference between those people who had something to live for versus those who had no meaning. Like, you can endure the most brutal, horrific sufferings if there's some sort of meaning.
Right.
But he said you could tell, like, the people who didn't have any purpose in their life, like, they just looked dead inside and they would quickly die. Like, they just didn't have anything to live for.
Right.
Both those in the camp, but then even after they were liberated from the camps, like, there were some people who...
they couldn't get beyond the experience of the camp and find a purpose to move forward right. in life.
I love Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning is one of my favorite books ever. And I kind of felt like this book was sort of that experience of people whose lives don't really have any meaning.
It reminds me of that podcast I was telling you about. I was listening to the Art of Manliness podcast, and they had, I forget what the exact episode it was, but he had an author on who writes about finding your purpose. And he talked about his own experience where, as a 60-plus-year-old guy, finding out that his dad did not die in World War II, like his mom had told him, but in fact, actually, he learned it when he was younger, but had never had any contact with his dad. And then in his 60s, his adult daughter came to him and said, I found out about your father, you know, about who he is and what his life was like. And then by finding out about this stuff, it gave him a connection and helped him. He talked about this in the context of we are constantly having to find our purpose in life. That purpose is a constant exercise, like the search for purpose. And it doesn't have to be world changing, earth shattering purpose. There isn't necessarily just one. I have a purpose of being a husband and a father, and purpose as a podcaster, but also other purposes, other things that give my life meaning.
Right, but you have to have some sort of meaning to, like, just get out of bed in the morning.
Right.
Like,
there has to be a reason outside of myself to do the things I do. For there to, like, you mentioned that one of the characters, she just stopped eating because what's the point? Like, I'm not interested. Like, I'm eating alone, and why go to any effort to make anything interesting? It's just me, you know? And she's lost even the purpose of eating. So, yeah, it sounds interesting.
I mean, it was a very interesting in terms of sort of a portrait of reality. I mean, in a way, this is what fiction does, is it holds up a mirror to the
life.
World,
yeah.
to life as it is. And I mean, it was kind of a lot of it was sort of depressing. And yet I found myself kind of wanting to keep reading because I really wanted the people in the novel to find some sort of purpose, to find a meaning in life. And I guess they kind of did, but except I felt like the one woman, Marcia, she kind of dies with no sense of purpose.
Right.
Although there's a little hint that the nurse who attends her deathbed says that, you know, she just really looked beautiful and transformed at the moment of death. Like, maybe there was something.
Maybe purpose can be found even at the moment of death.
Yeah. Like, maybe it's hard to tell from outside what sort of internal experience she had.
Maybe her purpose was found when she left the house to this guy. That, like, her purpose was fulfilled in bringing these three people together again.
Right. I mean, it seems kind of depressing, like, to think that my purpose in life is to give other people meaning in life.
Well, I mean, that's kind of parenthood.
but on the other hand, I mean, it was kind of beautiful at the same time.
Well, it's a selfless purpose, that's for sure. I mean, shouldn't that be what purpose is about? Is it not about what we do for ourselves, but what we do for others?
Right. I mean, in a way, she sort of did have this, like, self-giving moment. Like, she did do something for him that
right
kind of knocked him out of himself.
Right. Right. And then by, as you say, by proxy, the others as well. So
anyway, it was an interesting novel, and I'm looking forward to reading more Barbara Pym. Maybe some people who love her can suggest their favorite novels so that I can have.
Was she the one that I was telling you that Amazon had a series based on the novel?
I have no idea.
Oh, I'll have to look it up. I'm not going to do it now, but the guy who plays Moriarty in the...
Andrew Scott
was starring in a new Amazon Prime limited series, which we used to call miniseries, based on a 1940s British novel by a female British novelist. And I don't know if... I thought it was Barbara Pym, but now may have it all mixed up in my head. So, never mind.
Okay.
So, well, if I find it, I'll talk about it next time.
All right. Maybe I'll watch it.
Maybe you'll watch it. Let's talk about today, as we record this on Sunday, is the Feast of the Assumption, the Solemnity of the Assumption.
Solemnity of the Assumption.
And we had a rip-roaring homily today.
Oh, my goodness. I was literally crying, like tears running down my face, and I didn't have any tissues or hankies in my pocket, so they just kind of dried in my face.
Father Elias, who's one of the Nigerian priests, who he helps out at our parish, not assigned to it.
Right, he's just sort of a visiting...
He's a student at Boston College, and because our pastor is Nigerian, they must have connected up, and so he does masses in our parishes on occasion. So he was there, and there were three things I got from today's readings about the Feast of the Assumption of Mary assumed into heaven, body and soul.
So first, Father Elias.
Let me talk about the first reading.
Oh, okay.
Before we get into Father Elias' thing. So there's a variety of readings, and so let me find the one that we did for Mastering the Day.
We had the woman clothed in the sun, right?
Right. The for the Mastering the Day from Revelations 12. And the great sign appeared in the sky, a woman clothed with the sun with a moon under her feet and on her head, a crown of 12 stars. She was with child and wailed aloud in pain as she labored to give birth. Then another sign appeared in the sky. It was a huge red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns, and on its head were 7 diadems. Its tail swept away a third of the stars in the sky and hurled them down to the earth. And when he read that, I said, isn't it interesting that the Perseid meteor showers, which are the biggest meteor showers of the year, occur right at the Assumption, like right around the Assumption every year.
So a third of the stars
cast from the heavens, like as a reminder, like obviously not, they're not actual stars. They're meteors, they're rocks falling through the atmosphere. But I just think it's kind of cool how even nature tells the tale of scripture. It speaks to us of God.
Interesting. The heavens proclaim the glory of God.
That's the phrase I was trying to remember. Yes. So in this case, the heavens literally are proclaiming the glory of God by reminding us of this scripture that we will hear on that Sunday.
That's one of my favorite scripture readings, I have to say. I love the image of the woman clothed in the sun. I love the way, I remember listening to one of Scott Hahn's Bible studies on Revelation and him talking about how it says God's temple in heaven opened and the Ark of the Covenant could be seen in the temple.
And then we go right to
a great sign appeared in the sky, a woman clothed in the sun. The woman clothed in the sun is the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. Exactly.
Revealed
in the temple
in the temple in heaven.
Right. Because what does the Ark of the Covenant hold? It holds God's covenant, God's promise.
And Jesus
is the Father's promise to us.
He's the new covenant.
Right. He is the covenant. And so she's the Ark. I mean, that is one of her traditional titles, is Ark of the Covenant. Right. In Our Lady of Guadalupe, that image is a depiction of this. The woman clothed with the sun with the moon under her feet and on her head a crown of 12 stars, who is with child. I mean, that is Our Lady of Guadalupe, that image. So it's I love this voice. And then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, now have salvation and power come and the kingdom of God and the authority of his anointed one. I love the imagery in this and the dragon, you know, and the Nahash from the book of Genesis in the Garden of Eden. It wasn't a little snake hanging from a branch, folks. It was Nahash, the dragon that Adam had to face down. Adam and Eve together.
I think Western art has sort of shortchanged us in our in our mental imagery of the story.
Yeah, because Adam didn't do what Jesus did, which was to throw himself in front of his bride Eve in that case, the church in Jesus's case, and sacrifice his own himself for the sake of his bride, with confidence and trust in God that you would be raised again. So Jesus makes up for the sin of Adam in that case. So that was the first reading. I wanted to mention that. So Father Elias tells a story. Now go ahead and tell what he was said in his homily.
So he started off by talking about how we often misunderstand the Assumption of Mary. And he used as an example a pilgrimage that he took to the Holy Land. And he talked about how their tour guide was an Israeli who was not Catholic.
He was a Christian, but not Catholic.
And he was very dismissive. Like they toured the
where were they when they?
I think he
mentioned like a bunch of places they went to.
Right, he mentioned a bunch of places.
Was it the Garden of Gethsemane?
It was either the Garden of Gethsemane or it was the Mount of the Assumption.
Olives.
The Ascension.
The Ascension. It was probably the Mount of the Ascension.
So he was saying that. So he was telling the story of like the Ascension, and he said, you know, some people believe that Mary was
assumed
to heaven. That's Catholics not true.
What he said was Catholics assume Mary is in heaven, and that's why it's called the Assumption of Mary.
Oh,
which is not at all what it means. Right.
So Father Elias said, I'm a Catholic priest, and this is totally wrong. Yeah. And
you're wrong, and you shouldn't say that anymore. Yes. Like, he was very, very direct. In a very direct Nigerian priest sort of the way that Nigerian priests have a certain way of speaking like that in very with authority, which I love. And he did that.
It was beautiful. Just sort of you can't say that. That's wrong. That's
you're talking
not,
about my mother.
Right. That's not what we believe. And you can't talk about my mother that way. And he talked about like, you know, I love my mother. Like talking about his earthly mother, his mother.
Right.
You know, I love my mother. I cherish her. She's beautiful. She's wonderful. I wouldn't let anything happen to her.
And so why would you think that Jesus would let anything bad happen to his mother?
To his mother.
Right. He talked about like all the places Mary was. He was the wedding at Cana and what Jesus did there and how she followed him to the foot of the cross and
how he gave her
and gave John to her. And Jesus took care of his mother. And of course he would assume her into heaven so that she would not suffer the corruption of death. And the decay.
And he didn't mention specifically, but if Mary is the Ark of the Covenant, then if God, how did God treat the
Ark itself?
The Ark itself
was holy.
It was holy. Like if anyone touched it irreverently, they were struck down dead.
Yes.
How much more so Mary, who actually held God himself.
The Godhead.
So of course she didn't like... Well, go into the tomb and...
By the way, the other thing Father said to the tour guide, if Mary wasn't assumed into heaven, show me here in the Holy Land where her tomb is, because she was revered above all the apostles. We know where every single one of them is buried. We know where all of the patriarchs are buried. We have all of their tombs and all of the churches everywhere. Where's her tomb? Christians would not let her be buried and lost, her tomb lost. She is...
Right. If Mary had died and been buried... Her tomb would be the most important pilgrimage site
after the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Right. It would be a massive, major pilgrimage site.
It would probably be the biggest church in the Holy Land, but there's nothing.
And there's no church. There's a Church of the Dormition.
Right.
And there's the church at Ephesus of, you know, Mary's house.
Mary's house where she lived with John after the resurrection.
But there is no church of with the tomb of Mary.
Right. So. so that was part one of his homily.
Okay, and then he got more personal, and he told us why he had such passion for Mary as his mother, because he wanted to tell the witness of the great things that Mary had done for him personally, and this was incredibly moving.
So he was in seminary. He was in the last year, final year of seminary, preparing for ordination, and. He went to the spiritual director and the list of the men to be ordained coming this year was up, and he and his friend were not on it
for some inexplicable reason, even though he'd finished all of his classes and done
everything that was required of him. And he went to the rector and he didn't know why. And it's just the way it is. I mean, they have so many priests being ordained in Nigeria that it's like, There's so many of you, I can't
and
keep track.
I think he didn't get into details, but I think that there was a sort of an implication that the bureaucracy was just such that there was no way he was going to cut through it and get to the bottom of the problem.
So Father decided to take it to the top. He told his friend, "What we're gonna take care of this.
There's one person
who will go right to the top of it for us, Mary." So he told his friend, "We're going to get up every night at 3 o'clock in the morning and go to the chapel and pray before Mary for an hour.
I love this. We're going to sneak into the chapel. Because clearly they weren't supposed to be in the chapel at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So it was very clear that they were sneaking around.
Now I think I know why Father was left off the list for ordination. This was his personality.
So they
snuck into the chapel and prostrated themselves before Mary and prayed there for an hour for her intercession because they so wanted to be ordained to become priests.
Begging her to be ordained. Begging her intercession with her son that they could become priests.
And they did this every night for 3 months.
3 months.
And then just before ordination.
He said 2 days before the ordination.
A new list came out and he and his friend were on it.
No explanation. One said anything to them.
just were there.
Their names were suddenly on the list and they were ordained.
And that's why he took as his middle name Mary. He is Father Elias Mary. That's how he is officially known.
Yes.
So
I loved that. And he's just like his love for Mary, his passion for her, his devotion to her was so infectious.
He's telling everyone that they should
pray the rosary.
Pray the rosary. It will change the world. It will change your life. And he was bemoaning the fact that there were a lot of Catholics out there. And this may surprise you if you're at all a devout Catholic. A lot of Catholics don't even know the Hail Mary prayer. Catholics.
Right. He said when he prayed the Our Father with people, everyone knows the Our Father and would say it along. But there are a lot of Catholics who don't even know the Hail Mary.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, as a graduate of Catholic school, I can't even believe that anyone doesn't know the Hail Mary.
It both shocks me and doesn't surprise me at the same time. It's the world we live in. I mean, there are people who do not Catholics who go to church every Sunday who don't even know the very basics of not even just Catholicism, but of Christianity and of the Bible. And I mean, remember you teaching CCD with the kids who didn't know who Noah was or Moses.
They didn't know who Abraham was. When I said something about Abraham, they asked me if I meant Abraham Lincoln.
Yep. Yeah. These
were the kids who were in CCD.
Yeah. And they weren't like toddlers. They were, you know, so
fourth grade,
9, 10 years old. I mean, yeah. So not surprising. I don't know. It gives me renewed hope. I mean, we pray every night. What's the prayer we're praying in night prayer?
Compline.
No. At the end of night prayer, the Marian prayer.
Yeah. It changes to depending on the liturgical season. Right now, it's the
Hail Holy Queen.
Holy Queen.
Could not get it out. we pray the Hail Holy Queen and our kids know it. They know it by heart. And that's beautiful. This is what it's about. Oh, one of the things I wanted to mention, speaking of our kids praying, one of the scout leaders told us that they were telling us how the kids are doing. And they said, yeah, they went to bed early last night. And Isabella and Sophia and Ben were praying together, night prayer from memory together in their tent before bed.
Yeah, Ben went over to the girls' tent and prayed with them before going to bed.
And this was something they set up on their own. We didn't say, now make sure you pray prayers together every night. They planned this. They told me that they were going to do this, they figured out that they need to pray together every night.
I think the girls had done that before another camping trip.
They did it on the last camping trip, on the canoe trip.
Yeah.
And Ben and I prayed in his tent. But they've memorized the prayers of night prayer, so most of the Psalms. So it's pretty awesome. So not only is it good for them, it's also a great witness. They are evangelizing by their witness to the other scouts.
Yeah.
Many of whom are not Christian or Catholic, or if they're Catholic, they don't really practice. So it is a great witness. I'm very proud of them for that.
So proud.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mary, she's a great mom.
Yes.
We should all spend more time with her.
Yes, we should.
And
so, all right. That should do it. Let's take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Brian T., Jacob W., Tim H., Bill B., and Ron T. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. If you've got any feedback for us, you have any suggestions of Barbara Pym novels or other things like that, let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's B-E-T-T-S. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And links from our discussion are in our show notes on sqpn.com. Be sure to join the StarQuest fan club by texting StarQuest to 66866. Send StarQuest to 66866. Follow the prompts. You're going to get special emails and some inside information. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.